So what Ratnagosha invited me to talk about was wisdom in the context of the five spiritual faculties, and he titled the talk Wisdom, the View from the Summit. I'm not sure if that's what I'm going to deliver, but I'll try that. So it's a short talk with some pauses for reflection. The talk that it was scheduled for a much earlier date, and it turned out to be the day that Bhante Sangharaksha died. And so that changed the talk. I mean, for one thing, I had a lot more time to think about it, but also, the talk included some of his thinking, but it just sort of became more apparent, really, as I've been dwelling a bit more on my connection with him. And I was thinking, I mean, if you want to really, you could keep your eyes closed during the talk. Like, I'm going to read it quite a bit because evenings are not the time for me to talk just freely. And if you just want to rest your seeing sense in that way and just take in what you're hearing, how that might be quite interesting, really, and see what resonates with you. And I was thinking I really want to dedicate this talk to Bhante Sangharaksha, but also to everyone who tries their best to communicate the Dharma. it's not that easy, really. So to start with, I just want to invite you for a couple of minutes of quiet reflection. You just want to make yourself comfortable, whatever works for you. What does wisdom mean to me right now? What does wisdom mean to me right now? Maybe now you're somewhere closer to the situation where I found myself in when I started thinking about this talk. My initial inner response was a real blank and a bit of unease. So I was with that for a while and then listened to some Dharma talks about wisdom, especially wisdom as one of the five faculties. And one of those talks was by Subhavata Mati. So she's been practicing for a very long time. Yeah, she's been an order member for a long time, active in the order in various ways for a long time. And this eminently experienced Dharmacharini opens her talk on wisdom with a bit of an embarrassed laughter and says, "I don't know what to say." And a bit later she says, "It's quite hard to know where to start. I think maybe 20 years ago I'd have quite a few things to say. Not so much today. The more deeply you go into things, you'd think one would be getting closer. What you realize is the vastness of things, how unfathomable something like wisdom is, how much you don't know. I've become less sure of what is meant by Buddhist wisdom, maybe not so much less sure, but more sure that it's bigger and vaster than I ever thought it was. The Buddha's wisdom is not only vaster than we suppose, but also vaster than whatever we can suppose. And that resonated with me then, and it still does, although I haven't practiced as long as the Bhadramati. So this talk is a bit of a dialogue between what's traditionally said about Buddhist wisdom, especially in the context of the five faculties, on the one hand, and then on the other hand, wisdom more as a practice also for openness to mystery, and allowing for wisdom to be vaster than we can suppose. So to start with, Bhante Sangharaksha sort of defined wisdom in various ways, and one is, he said, sort of broadly speaking in Buddhism, pranya, wisdom, or knowledge, is coterminous with the Dharma understood as truth, principle, reality. More specifically, it consists in seeing things as they really are, rather as they appear to be. And well, I mean, one might think, of course I see things as they are. You know, why ever wouldn't I? And I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. You know, why ever wouldn't I see things as they are? So Buddhist teachings kindly disagree. But first I thought I'd clarify a bit sort of what is sort of meant by things and what is meant by sort of really and what kind of truth, yeah, what kind of reality. So Buddhist wisdom is informed by this fundamental principle that we call conditionality or conditioned co-production. Everything that exists has come into being dependent on particular causes and conditions. And when those causes and conditions cease, the things that depend on them will also cease. And Buddhism takes an experiential approach to that, yeah? So it's a more existential approach, if you will. So things and truth and reality, they relate to knowing mind and consciousness from the inside, yeah? As Bhikkhu Bodhi puts it. So he says sort of it's from the perspective of one's own living experience. Yeah, one seeks insight of wisdom, a personal knowledge, whose whole value lies in its transformative impact on one's life. So Bhikkhu Bodhi compares this to the sort of Western scientific project, yeah, which also sort of aims at reality. But he says it's from the outside rather than from the inside. And it's a debatable comparison, of course, and debatable concept for sure. Which in a way I want to leave that up to mystery, whether Buddhism and Western science approach the same type of reality. But what's relevant for me tonight is that the Buddhist principle of conditionality is really more a description of what we can actually see and know about all elements of our experience, as the Buddha puts it. So, and from the point of view of Buddhist teachings, to the degree that I experience life as unsatisfactory, frustrating, scary, or pointless, I do not see things as they really are. And there are tons of variations, sort of subtle variations on that, the sort of frustratingness. So instead, I'm caught up in appearances, Buddhist teachings say, particularly the appearance of myself or other people in the world as being more permanent and substantial as they really are. And that causes sort of unnecessary struggles, yeah? Not wanting things to be as they are, wanting for them to be different. So again, sort of to come back to Bhikkhu Bodhi's sort of summary of sort of early scriptures, the main cause of our bondage and suffering is ignorance, not understanding things as they really are. And that's the antidote needed to heal ourselves is wisdom or insight. And one way the Buddha tried to communicate the implications of that, yeah, not seeing how things are, seeing how things are, is the list of the Four Noble Truths, yeah, that you probably all know. The truth of dukkha, that's often translated as suffering or unsatisfactoriness. And the truth of the origin of dukkha, the truth of the cessation of dukkha, and the truth of the path to the cessation of dukkha. Now, Dharma teachings are full of sort of lists and maps, and Vatnagosha talked about that, their purpose, when he introduced this series. Yeah, and he said a lot of these lists and maps are sort of aid memoirs for Buddha's for the Buddha's many teachings, and they often try to hold those teachings in a particular comprehensive way. Regarding wisdom, I think there's a bit more to explore here, sort of in terms of different types of knowledge. Sort of what's a map compared to experience, say. So just briefly imagine, yeah, there's a town for you to get to know, a town you don't know yet or not very well, and you were given a map. So just think about it. So what type are you? You know, are you the type to ignore the map and go out there into the town? Or are you maybe a bit intimidated by something new and foreign, unfamiliar? Maybe you want to sit at home and study that map for a long while. If you do go out and if you take that map with you, sort of how do you go about that? You know, sort of balancing the map and exploring the town. And what are the differences there between the sort of singular view that the map presents and your sort of quite rich experience of exploring the town? So for Buddhist wisdom practice, it really helps to discern different types of knowledge and knowing, in a way, exploring what's my relationship to them, what's my relationship to lists, and how do I apply them to something like walking a town, walking on the town of my own experience, if you will. So Sangharacha puts it this way. He says that if we never make these distinctions, we may flatter ourselves that the ideas and insights we embrace are our own, even our own experience. But by doing so, we will not allow ourselves the option of actually moving on to deeper and more personal investigation of reality, even perhaps eventually the possibility of an actual experience of truth, a truly transformational wisdom. So we need to know, am I just, looking at a map over and over again, or just sort of recounting a map, or have I gotten to know something more deeply? So coming back to the Four Noble Truths, I could ask myself, am I available to the teachings conveyed here, and how could I be available? How can I come into a relationship with them? Especially a relationship that helps sort of towards freedom, happiness. So to open up wisdom practice, what Sangharacha often used is yet another list or map, and that's the one of three kinds of wisdom or three levels of wisdom. And that's a wisdom arising through listening and reading, wisdom arising through personal reflection, and wisdom arising through meditation. And I'll explore those first with an eye on dukkha and then more on a bigger overview and moving on from them. So wisdom arising through listening and reading is fairly basic, you might say, yeah? But it's a way sort of to come in contact with Buddhist teachings. And it is really rather relevant because that's how the Dharma has been communicated and passed on since the Buddha's taught it, and also how we communicate with each other. So regarding dukkha, I might read about it, I might sort of look up a couple of different translations, and maybe dukkha is suffering or unsatisfactoriness. And I might read or hear a bit about how dukkha is part of human experience, hear a couple of examples. And I might feel a straightforward response to that, maybe an intellectual response, but maybe that response is informed by my past life experience. And it can happen sort of on that level that very soon I feel, oh, I got this, yeah. And there can be a bit of a question of, is that it then? And Sangharacha says that depending on past life experience, obviously just reading or hearing Dharma teachings can make our deeper wisdom click into place, emerge or be recognized. And there are quite a few examples of that in the scriptures. I'm not going to go into them. But usually it's sort of limited in terms of wisdom because to some extent we can only relate to it as information. Yeah, even though, as Sangharacha says, we may flatter ourselves that it's our you know, deep experience. But actually, to some extent, it's just information. There's nothing wrong with that in a way. We just need to figure out how to let that flourish, yeah? How to let sort of some seed germinate. Somehow also look at possible roadblocks. Yeah. So, for example, on this in this way of engaging with wisdom or wisdom teachings, it could be that we get a bit too tight with ideas. Yeah. Say too tight with the idea of dukkha. Say I become familiar with that concept of dukkha, yeah, and it can be quite a useful way of talking to others and identifying what's going on for me. And maybe for some time it becomes the word to use. You know, everything I say about my experience as dukkha, or the worldly winds, you know, it's sort of something sort of I've just learned about it, I see it everywhere. And that's totally fine sort of as a way of getting to know it. But when it turns into a sort of shortcut, yeah, when I just keep saying that without actually knowing my experience more deeply, I'm selling myself short, yeah, and I'm preventing a sort of unfolding of understanding. In a way, I don't know what's really going on. Because I just brush it away. Oh yeah, it's dukkha. Oh, everything's dukkha. In a way, I forget what is needed in terms of what to look at and how. So in a way, so it's just something to keep asking myself: is awareness still investigating experience as I sort of use language to make sense of it? And sometimes, and some of us anyway, can get too tight with ideas, yeah, say with the idea of dukkha, as we explore more and more scriptures, yeah, more and more teachings. Yeah, maybe we get interested in different translations and in all the different ways teachers have talked about it. And that can be very, very useful. Sometimes, though, it doesn't lead to knowing my own mind more. Yeah, if I don't let it permeate, yeah, that sort of journey of sort of chasing ideas. And then actually what can happen is that I might be unaware of how I perceive new information, yeah, sort of the bias that I bring to that sort of study. And in a way, I'm just getting stuck. So it's more like, they're not really roadblocks or things like, oh, you mustn't do this. It's more, okay, this can happen, human nature, what do I do? You know, how can I sort of engage with wisdom teachings a bit more creatively? And one way of sort of becoming sort of more creative is sort of the second type or the second level of wisdom, yeah, sort of through personal reflection, which is more about taking a teaching on and thinking about it in a more spacious way. Is this true? How is this true? What does this mean? And in a way, the crucial point here is to make it personal. Yeah, not in the sense of appropriating it, yeah, not in the sense of sort of built up as some sort of ego identity, but bringing it alive and daring to explore what I don't know as well. So what does it really mean? You know, what does dukkha really mean? What do I really know? Is there really dukkha when I feel happy, for instance? Yeah, that's a really interesting inquiry. Is there dukkha when I enjoy righteous anger? So what kinds of suffering might there be? Yeah, what kind of dissatisfaction? Are there maybe different types of dukkha? And at different times, really, dukkha may mean different things to me, yeah, just like wisdom. But that's part of my journey, and that's part of what I discover. And the journey is a lot about not trying to just accept somebody else's definition, but also being quite interested in other people's definitions and experiences and their understanding. And that all of that takes time and patience, relaxed and spacious mind. And it also takes courage, questioning what I know again and again, and not sort of holding it too tightly. And I was sort of thinking sort of kind of sort of this type of reflection also turned into a bit of a roadblock in terms of wisdom practice. And I'm thinking maybe when there's too much investment in this conceptual process, yeah, and sort of basically having reflection as the main means of wisdom practice. And it can just mean that we're that are not open to other ways of knowing, yeah, that are not about about words or language at all. Bodily knowing, yeah, symbolic knowing, non-conceptual knowing. So one of those ways of knowing that sort of isn't really like reflection emerges in meditation practice, yeah, wisdom arising from meditation experience. And Kuladipa talked about meditation some weeks ago, so I'm not going there in terms of practice. I just want to sort of briefly mention sort of traditional ways in which wisdom is said to manifest in meditation when there are conducive conditions. Obviously, that's not always the case. So wisdom can arise in meditation experience through seeing conditioned existence as dukkha, yeah, as sort of exploring the unsatisfactoriness, exploring impermanence, and exploring the sort of no fixedness, the insubstantiality, especially the no fixedness of self. Also seeing the unconditioned as empty of dukkha, impermanence, and no fixed self. Seeing the very distinction between the conditioned and unconditioned as only provisional, only structured by thought. So in a way it's a sort of a pursuit of emptiness unfolding. And then also seeing the emptiness of the concept of emptiness itself and the emptiness of the concept of Buddhism and so on. So in a way, the sort of that kind of wisdom arising in meditation experience is beyond concepts, and I'm not going to go there very much. So there are many Buddhist accounts and similes about what that might be like, and there are practitioners who enjoy dwelling on you know, finding the right words for that. Yeah. So some say that as sort of wisdom through meditational practice sort of flourishes, you spontaneously see the interdependent co-arising nature of the world, directly experience the essentially empty nature of conditioned phenomena, and so on. Others say you have perfect knowledge of what is suffering and what is not suffering, are not longer subject to reactivity and so on. For me, really, wisdom practice in this context is about openness to my own experience and not needing to align myself too tightly with this or that account of perfect wisdom. In a way, there's no point, yeah? And to quote Ajahn Sumedho, let this be an open question, a mystery, live the question. What is possible in the way of freedom for me right now, in this very moment, just as I am? So for me, there's a connection to follow up that's sort of the most worthwhile, really, from specialized wisdom practice, as it's sort of described in these three types or levels, to everyday life. So expanding wisdom practice into how I experience life, how I act, and so on. In some way, sort of allowing wisdom to flow into everyday life and to flourish. So that's not to sort of dismiss the conducive conditions for wisdom, especially deep wisdom, to arise. Yeah. So wisdom practice certainly is about conducive conditions, especially conditions that are conducive to insight. And it can really help to identify them off the cushion, outside of study and reflection. And to be open to that as well in your own experience, not just sort of follow what teacher A says or teacher B says. So in the words of my friend Vajradevi, and I found that through my own experience, no matter what posture I'm in, no matter what I'm doing, and when my mind is aware with understanding, I can engage in wisdom practice. And that can be while I'm working, while I'm doing ritual, while I'm cleaning, while I'm talking to others, having a drink in the pub, and so on. Probably not anymore when I'm drunk. So that's sort of one thing that I'm quite keen on, in a way, this sort of expansion of wisdom practice. It's really good to have compartmentalized, specialized sort of practices that are labeled wisdom practice. But also the sort of flow over into life is really important in terms of for wisdom to be integrated, but also to see the possibility of wisdom practice in every moment, yeah, if I feel up to it. And also the list of these three kinds or levels of wisdom can give the impression of wisdom practice as intellectual activity with a slightly sort of narrow connotation. Sort of, and that gets more and more refined at each level. And in Buddhism, wisdom is associated with the intellect, but in its neutral definition, yeah, not with that sort of baggage of negative connotation. So more just as the faculty of reasoning and understanding objectively. And again, sort of bringing that into this context of Buddhist wisdom being about pursuit of sort of inner reality, experiential reality. So it's not about abstract information when we say objectively. It's about understanding experience with a perspective that's broader than a sort of tied attachment to I, me, or mine. Just to open that up a bit more, so if I want to give you a couple of, a few more traditional connotations with prana or wisdom, and I'm just going to read them slowly, and maybe one or two of them speak to you, especially sort of in terms of your everyday practice. Understanding, search for Dharma, discernment, discrimination, differentiation, subtlety, clarity, investigation, amplitude, sagacity, a guide to true welfare and to the marks as they truly are, comprehension, a goad which urges the mind to move back to the right track, virtue and strength, that cannot be dislodged by ignorance. The light, luster, and splendor of wisdom, absence of delusion, right view. Everyday life requires us to open, to sort of operate on tons of assumptions to function and get things done. And that, in a way, is an interesting situation for wisdom practice. So many assumptions are fairly neutral, sort of karmically speaking. But it's always sort of good to watch out for when they're not, and to watch out for dukkha arising. Yeah? Say when I expect the post office to be open and it isn't. Yeah? Or I expect there not to be a queue and there is one. Yeah, sort of what's my experience of this? And not just on the surface, where I might find an attitude of, oh, never mind. But sort of what's my experience of this in detail and depth, in terms of assumptions in the everyday world and meeting reality. So sort of looking into everyday life situations, nearly every life situation carries a flavour of dukkha. And usually, there's a specific constellation of what's called in Buddhism defilements and kleshas. And the chance to face them, investigate and understand their nature, I mean, which is for me one of the reasons why wisdom practice outside of meditation is so helpful. Yeah, sort of have it whenever we meet the difficulty or the knottedness in our experience. So this isn't about deliberately seeking out difficult situations, yeah, not necessarily anyway. So engaging with other people is usually all that it takes. And bringing awareness to when I relate to others and the world, especially sort of when this sort of sense of self and me versus others or them sort of is relevant. So quite some years ago, I lived and worked at Anakosha for a while, and I was quite inspired at the time what happened to me in my metta bhavana practice, which was sort of, as I brought people to mind, I was subtly aware of how it fixed them or how it would also experience envy or something, you know, trying to cultivate metta. So there was a sort of rich jumble in the mind, and I decided to pursue that sort of in everyday life in a particular way. Sort of especially during the work day, sort of I looked at sort of how I got fixed ideas about other people around me, and with that I mean more fixed than necessary to cooperate with them. And so I explored sort of the flavors of this sort of getting fixed ideas of people and sort of various conditions that were involved and how these ideas arose and stabilized. And I could start off with noticing that I was a slight dislike towards someone, and that sort of subtle tendency to avoid them, but also judging their actions from afar, and exploring often involves sort of going into that experience a bit more, tasting it and tasting the dukkha that was there, and how I sort of tightened around them and towards them. And sometimes sort of there was an interest in, oh, where has this arisen from, where did they come from? And often it went back to a very tiny situation where this person didn't behave the way I expected them to behave, and there was disappointment, and so I somehow started not liking them. So there was a whole other avenue of investigation into implicit expectations I had towards people and towards communication and so on. And some of these expectations dropped in the process, and others, I think for me, sort of led to finding out more about what I value, where my values are, what's important to me. And so this kind of patient practice didn't sort of jump to conclusions or force change. I didn't hurry into becoming a better person. I didn't force myself to be a better person. So sometimes I would watch for days how some sort of slight unease towards another person led to, very subtle avoidance strategies, and what the effects of that were. That in a way I couldn't actually know them more fully because I didn't allow myself to. Or how sometimes a fixed view sort of got more fixed because I complained to that person, to someone else, and in that sort of story, it got all stronger. So, in a way, sort of what I was exploring was the views and attitudes, but in a very broad way, and how they sort of changed in interaction. I would usually spend sort of a little bit of my evening sort of reviewing what I noticed and doing that in a metta practice, because they seem to be always sort of a bit more to see, a bit more to find out. And what I often experience in that metta practice in particular, but also in everyday life, was sort of a combination of seeing something a bit more clearly, discovering something, say, this is what ignorance is like, or this is how dislike fixes someone. But it would be sort of, as that seeing happened, there would be a particular type of warmth sort of meeting that. So what I later learned, sort of, a particular form of compassion. And that gave me a lot of confidence in my own practice. And in a way, for me, that is, it's one of the marks of, does my practice work, or in particular, does wisdom practice work? In a way, it isn't wisdom practice if there isn't an ongoing warmth towards what I'm discovering, and ongoing sort of even delight in the seeing, but also a sort of compassion towards any dukkha I'm encountering. So if that's not there really, then it sort of needs looking into. And so for me, this kind of practice continues and has taken different forms over time. In a way, the underlying wisdom practice is about sort of how can I remain open to emptiness, as I act in the world, where the distinction between me and others sort of manifests in many ways. And what's that like when I'm tired, when I'm in pain, when I'm otherwise contracted? Sort of where are the spaces, where sort of softness possible? And when it's not, sort of, how can I be soft with that? In a way, can I sort of nurture openness to the possibility of not knowing myself or someone else as much as I thought I did? Motives, dukkha, potential. Can I notice when I write someone off, or when I write myself off in a moment, when I think there's nothing more to gain? So for me, sort of wisdom practice is really, it's quite responsible, responsive and flexible. And I pursue it whether or not there's an identifiable other or world involved. The thing is sort of, whenever I'm emphasizing action and relating to other people, sort of the world comes to me through the senses as experience, which is where awareness sort of attends, and ideally attends with understanding. So this is the essential working ground of wisdom practice all the time. it's not really self-absorption or solipsism, but in a way, in wisdom practice, this distinction between outer and inner matters less than we think. Yeah, so what we're examining is experience. And this sort of self and other in a way in there is always relative, yeah, dependent on conditions and changing. So I mean nowadays I personally sort of do more wisdom practice sort of that covers ground either along the skandhas or constants as they're called, and I don't really want to go into yet another list, another sort of way of looking at Buddhist practice. But what I often sort of, what often sort of awareness follows is, where's the energy in this? So I'm not really just banging myself over the head with a particular mindfulness teaching or wisdom teaching. Say, when I notice agitated thinking, if I sat in the audience, I would probably have some agitated thinking by this point. Like, how much longer is she going on? Oh God, and then there's going to be a ritual. I hope it's not in call and response. And sort of in a way, I could sort of just do wisdom practice here by saying, oh, that's just thinking and leave it at that. But for me, whenever there's some emotion involved and some sort of rich energy, it's worth more investigation. So in that case, I would investigate the agitation and the sort of probably find there's some desperation and tightness that, in my case, often leads back to bodily tightness and pain. And it's worth sort of tracking through the skandhas, sort of through how in every one of the constants or skandhas, momentary experience gets a bit more fixed and sort of comes together to something which then feels like, oh, there's me suffering from this overlong talk and, I need to get out of here. So in a way, what I'm trying to do is for every situation to be my teacher, and I mean, that can sound very fluffy. So for one thing, I think what's quite important to look into is that, there's this sort of folk wisdom, including among Buddhist practitioners, that we learn most from what's unpleasant or difficult. Yeah, that sort of, I had a really, really hard time, but I learned so much from it. And we can learn a lot from those difficult times. And in a way, when it is very difficult, probably the desperation for practice is stronger. But if I only recognize difficulties as vehicle to sort of deeper wisdom, I miss a lot of opportunities. And I know that for myself, yeah, because I do live with a lot of pain and difficulty, and I'm more adept at practicing in that realm. And on the occasional day when I feel fine, I can feel a bit like, what's there to do? I don't quite know what to do. Often, sort of, for me, then wisdom practice is really quite simple. Exploring what's it like to feel expansive, yeah, what's it like to feel at ease, what's it like to feel more emotionally available to myself and others. And I often find then awareness explores more subtle sort of emanations of dukkha, like fear of my own capacity, yeah, fear of my own potency. Or fear of change, yeah, I don't know myself in this particular manifestation. Sometimes I detect a sort of a flavour of hubris in that expansive mood, yeah, that's also worth exploring. So wisdom practice is often for me about sort of gently being with experience, yeah, sort of this sort of kshanti aspect of it, exploring its various elements, sort of various elements of experience in all their glory or misery. The sort of allowing every situation to be my teacher is easier said than done, and it really can sound, like a platitude. Yeah, sort of, what is wisdom practice like when I feel very tired, or too tired to practice? When I feel overwhelmed, when I'm convinced that I know everything there is to know about this experience, yeah, when I'm convinced I know everything already. So those are always interesting situations, yeah. Say when I'm feeling too tired to practice, what is practice like? I probably just need to practice giving myself a break over and over and over. And wisdom practice always wants to know what's that like? Yeah, what's it like to feel overwhelmed? What's it like to feel tired? What's it like to feel like I know it all? How does awareness relate to whatever I'm experiencing? And also, what's the most kindly thing to do right now? So just to briefly come back to the five faculties, for me really, I'm really thank you for bringing them sort of out again in Sadaraja. So for me, there's something about how wisdom practice flows with mindfulness. Yeah, sort of in a way, wisdom brings spaciousness to mindfulness. Mindfulness can be a bit sort of moment to moment, and wisdom often sort of also includes a broader perspective in a particular way. And also sort of is interested in seeing the effects of practice over time. And wisdom practice both requires energy, but it also tempers energy, that often energy can go off in the wrong things, yeah, sort of trying too hard, or being invested in wrong views, which then causes harm. And often sort of what's needed really is energy to sustain receptivity, yeah, sort of patiently being with experience more fully, rather than rushing into doing something sort of driven by an idea of what, you know, how to save the world, how to save all beings. So they all sort of inspire each other, I think, these faculties, and can deepen each other. And wisdom practice thrives on faith. Yeah? It's not just tempered by faith or sort of balanced by faith, but it also thrives on faith. It depends on the quiet confidence of faith, the confidence in teachings, in my own potential. And it also comes to fruition, I think, as wise faith, yeah, the ability to bear not knowing, yeah, not knowing what's going on, not knowing what to do, and allowing knowing to flourish from this continuity of gentle awareness. And I want to finish here, even though my talk isn't quite finished, I'm going to finish here. In a way, sort of for me, what I haven't managed really to bring out is sort of what does it feel like when wisdom practice flourishes? So in a way, to me, it often is a relief. You know, there's a relief of say sometimes it's energy tied up in wrong views or assumptions, and there's a sort of relief as that goes, or there's a relief to see that, okay, there's some contraction, but I'm not totally invested in it. Yeah, there's more going on. But for me, really, the most inspiring confirmation of sort of how wisdom perhaps flourishes for me is how compassion sort of emerges. And that's very varied and very subtle, and it's taken me quite a long time to understand that that is what sort of general Buddhism talks about when they talk about the five chinnas. Yeah, often sort of when they were talked about, I couldn't connect that much because it was about symbols and it was about colours and it was about, I don't know, things that didn't seem to have anything to do with what I was doing in my mind. But when wisdom practice flourishes for me, there are these sort of subtle dances of, say, recognising there's a little bit of fixing going on in the mind, and then there's this flavour coming in of, oh, may I be all right with not knowing, and there's this sort of taste of Vairochana behind that, a sort of spaciousness and a very, very sort of open compassion. But it could equally be more along the lines of a bit of fearlessness, oh, when I sort of detect, oh, I'm holding on too tightly to something out of fear, and there's this fearlessness arising. And the thing is, for me, when things are going well, that's so natural that I find it really hard to talk about that. And also, I'm pretty sure it's not anything like that for you. So in a way, you have to find out how things are working for yourself. Yeah, nobody can do that for you. But what I thought I would be really nice to end with is the invocation of the five jhanas, which brings out a particular richness of wisdom for me. And in particular, also how that translates into compassion, yes, as it meets the world, as it meets our suffering.